The medical journal The Lancet published a study in April that showed a decline in the number of women dying each year from pregnancy and childbirth since 1980. It was the first positive news and the first hint of progress in decades, but the numbers are still high. According to the latest figures, nearly 343,000 women died in 2008, and although that figure was lower than the average for the last 30 years, which remained at around 500,000, it still is hundreds of thousands of women. Here to discuss the risks and causes of maternal mortality around the world are Lynn Friedman, director of the Averting Maternal Death and Disability Program and of the Law and Policy Project and professor of Clinical Population and Health Policy at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Also, Dr. Grace Cadindo, Assistant Clinical Professor of Population and Family Health at the Mailman School of Public Health and recipient of the Millennium Development Goal 3 Champion Torch in recognition of her efforts to secure comprehensive reproductive health care for women worldwide, and Belle Taylor-McGee, President of the California Coalition for Reproductive Freedom, former President and CEO of the Pacific Institute for Women's Health, co-author of the article Time to Save Women's Lives, in the spring issue of Ms. Magazine. Welcome to our show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And Belle, Belle, shouldn't we see the study in The Lancet that showed the drop in the maternal death rate as encouraging?
I think it definitely is encouraging, but as you mentioned, the numbers are still too high for anybody to rest. I mean, women are still dying from pregnancy complications and lack of access to skilled labor care. So the problem has not been arrested.
Lynn, is it difficult to even determine the maternal death rates around the world? I mean, how often are deaths during pregnancy and childbirth unreported or underreported?
Yes, I mean, it is very difficult to come up with exact numbers, and even the Lancet study certainly does not purport to do that. So the vast majority of deaths probably are not reported. The other important thing about these numbers is that they don't tell us anything about equality or inequality. So we don't know from these numbers who is dying.
And we should also point out that although the numbers are going down in some countries, in others they have gone up. Where have we seen the most progress?
Well, I think we've seen the most progress in a handful of countries. Countries such as Egypt has certainly shown progress. Bangladesh, some states in India, but in many countries where mortality is quite high, it's either stagnant or in some gone up.
Grace, why is the death rate so high in sub-Saharan Africa in particular?
Exactly, yeah, because you have talked about in some countries where it has been, it has increased. In Chad, my country, it has increased in 2008, actually. So in sub-Saharan Africa, we have many, many factors interacting that causing this lack of decrease. But one of them is the access to good quality services that could have helped saving women's life.
Prenatal care, for example.
Prenatal care, delivery cares, and emergency obstetric care, mostly. When women have complications, they need to be to have access to the emergency obstetric care services. And in Africa, the access to services is still a very important problem.
Do most women give birth at home?
Exactly. The majority of them are giving birth at home or in the very rural, very remote areas where access is a real problem in terms of financial access, in terms of even physical access, the roads. In some places, they have no roads. So when there's a complication during the nighttime, how to find emergency transportation to go to the hospital. And when they arrive, the services may not just be good qualities.
I'm assuming that midwives are performing most of these births. Are they trained midwives, or are the midwives more likely to be people who come out of traditional midwifery practices?
Yeah, most of them are coming. I mean, they are doing traditional, just like normal delivery. But they cannot, of course, provide a cesarean section or many other higher level of care that women may need when they have developed complications. And even that, women really delivering with skilled attendant birth at less than 50% in sub-Saharan Africa. So less than the majority only are having, you know, skilled attendants.
Why is there such a shortage of doctors? There are some pretty good universities in Africa.
Yes, in some places in Africa, they have some good university. You have many problems also on that. Sometimes the doctors prefer to remain in cities, in big cities. They don't want to be posted in remote areas.
So these deaths are generally taking place in underserved areas?
The majority of them, of course, yeah.
My guests are Dr. Grace Codindo, Lynn Friedman, and Belle Taylor-McGee. We're talking about the very high mortality rate still of girls and women throughout the world in childbirth. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Bell, we've been focusing on the developing world, but the maternal death rate in the United States has increased in the last 20 years, according to reports. Why is it so high here?
Well, when we look at the U.S., I mean, there are other factors that we look at when we think about maternal mortality, and basically it's how you measure a country's commitment to the health and well-being of women and girls. In the U.S., for example, we look at race, ethnicity, not only access to care, but other kinds of social factors that might impact a woman's access to reproductive health. So when you look at, for example, women of color, where the rate is higher in terms of maternal mortality or complications, a lot of that has to do with whether or not a woman is able to access those services. Can I just step back for a minute on the developing world? Because I want to talk a little bit about the transportation issue, and that is such a huge issue that cannot be underestimated. I just returned from Uganda and Tanzania, and we were really out in some of the most remote areas of those countries. And Professor, you're right about the roads. I mean, you're driving for miles and miles, and you don't see a healthcare facility, and you say to yourself, how do we expect women to get to care when they don't have roads to get there, when it's so far away from their village or their town? And women are in desperate need for, you know, skilled health facility. And the other thing I want to say, one of the things that we found out in Uganda, which, of course, where 6,000 women actually die each year from pregnancy-related causes, is that women actually are very much interested in planning and managing their reproductive health. They say that they can't get to a health facility. And sometimes when they get to those facilities, there aren't any supplies to support them. So there are myriad issues why we are finding women dying needlessly, and these are needless deaths. They're totally preventable.
Well, Lynn, getting back to the U.S., we don't have problems with highways, and we do have lots of hospitals, and usually we have some decent medical facilities near wherever people live. But according to the World Health Organization, the U.S. is 40th in the world, behind most other industrialized countries. So what are they doing that we're not doing?
That's a good question. But when we look at these numbers, we should also be clear that while the U.S. is not doing well compared to in other industrialized countries, the difference between the problem here and in developing countries is, of course, dramatic. These are different kinds of problems. But I think there was a study just released in the last few days here in New York City. It was reported in the Times this weekend about New York City's own problems with maternal mortality.
And part of the problem, they said, was obesity. Mm-hmm. Although New York City seems to have a lower obesity rate than many cities in this country, it still has led to infant mortality here and to the death of the women, the mothers. Why is obesity a problem?
Well, usually obesity goes along with some other medical complication like hypertension, like diabetes, and all these are high risk factors for women becoming pregnant with that.
Even when we're talking about somebody who's 16, 17 years old? I mean, are they already beset with hypertension at 16?
The younger one have also a real problem of having access. I mean, they may not have access to care. Mm. They don't go most of the time. So this comes back again to the lack of insufficient access to service that could have help them during pregnancy and during childbirth.
In Africa, it's being suggested that women being moved near hospitals in the final months of their pregnancies as a way of overcoming some of these problems, the distances. Is that even feasible?
Actually, it is not realistic in Africa because you see moving a woman to some places for weeks or months, I mean, the whole family have to divide the resources by two or three. And this is really not realistic for many, many African families. You know, it's really out of the reach because of the resources that they may have to share. It has been tried in many places, but we have not really shown that it has any real impact or any success because of the socio-economical consequences.
Mel, what are the most common causes of death during childbirth? We mentioned high blood pressure. What about some of the others?
Yes, you have many other like a hemorrhage. Hemorrhage before or after deliveries. We have infections. We have consequences of unsafe abortions. We have also problem of dystocic. I mean, women having been married too early, so the pelvises have not been developed enough because.
Sometimes that leads to even a breakthrough to the colon, doesn't it? Or there are other, it leads to tears inside the woman's body.
Exactly. So during the delivery, I mean, the prolonged labor could cause child death because the baby is descending in the pelvis to come out. If he's stuck in the pelvis, he may die from asphyxia. Or mother can have ruptured uterus, or even she may end up with fistula at the end. So prolonged also labor is one of the cause of maternal mortality in infection, in postpartum infection also.
Fistula is actually one of the serious consequences that can happen from obstructed labor, and it has a very serious social impact on women who then have leakage of urine or feces, which ends up being the cause for real for ostracism from their communities and serious discrimination.
But fistulas are more common in the developing world because girls tend to get married younger or at least have children younger.
Yes, and also these are women who very often actually do not get access to the care that can avoid it, like a cesarean section. So in this country, I mean, even if you have prolonged or obstructed labor, virtually always, whatever your socioeconomic status, you do get access to that kind of care.
Now, some years back, Bell, people were concerned that we were performing too many cesareans. Is that no longer an issue in this country?
Well, I think it's relative. I think that it's definitely still an issue and a cause for concern, but I think it's certainly one of those issues that's been addressed probably better than most. I want to say something just a little bit more about fistula, too, because it is a big problem. For example, in Uganda, for every woman who dies, six survive with a chronic or a debilitating condition like fistula. And while we were in Uganda and we were there for a community meeting in one of the villages where over 250 men and women and villagers came to hear the message about safe motherhood, it was just amazing. I was approached by a woman who approached me quite quietly, concerned about her privacy, obviously, who had been living with fistula for a number of years and did not know that she could be repaired. And so it was the first time she said she'd ever heard anyone even talk about her condition, and it was like hearing her story for the very first time.
What happens with fistula is you women are incapable of controlling themselves, and so they have leakage, often urinary leakage, but it can be any kind of leakage, and then they're ostracized by the members of their family and their village because they smell bad. They're not like other people. And as you say, there is a simple operation that will repair most cases, not all cases, I gather, but most cases.
Exactly. So now that she knows that she can be repaired, she said she will collect the money from her family and her community to get the help and to get to the hospital, which is about 13 kilometers away. But the interventions of getting women to a facility earlier so that they have an action plan. It's something that's begun to resonate throughout Africa, because communities are beginning to look at that. In some cases, we noted in Tanzania that there were communities who were now collecting funds so that women could have access to transportation to get to a skilled facility. So some of those interventions, while we haven't seen a large or huge impact, they do make a difference for women. And that's part of the Safe Motherhood message, is to have women think early about get your action plan. What will you do? How will you get there? And so women are beginning to do that.
We have to take a little break, and we'll come back with more of my guests, Belle Taylor McGee, Dr. Grace Cadindo, and Lynn Friedman. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. We're back with Lynn Friedman, Director of the Averting Maternal Death and Disability Program at Columbia University's Mailman School of Public Health. Also from Mailman is Dr. Grace Cadindo, Assistant Clinical Professor of Population and Family Health, and Belle Taylor McGee, President of the California Coalition for Reproductive Freedom. She wrote an article called Time to Save Women's Lives in the spring issue of Ms. Magazine. I want to talk about the three delays that cause problems. Lynn, can you explain what they are?
Sure. Well, to address maternal mortality, the key is that when a woman has a complication that can kill her, she needs to get to the care that can save her life. And at Columbia some years ago, we looked at all of the evidence about what prevents a woman from reaching that care and surviving a complication. And we were able to divide it into really three basic delays. And those were the first delay, which was the decision to seek care. The second delay, the time it took to get from your home or the decision to seek care to the care itself. And then the third delay was once you were at a facility, the delay in actually receiving the care that you need. And what that showed us was that the problem is both one of demand, or getting people to the facility, but it was also very much a problem in the facility and having the health system actually work well to make sure that it was ready and addressed an emergency with urgency.
Grace, are some doctors in Africa being taught how to repair fistulas when they first occur?
Yes, exactly. And the Addis Ababa Fistula Hospitals is one of the hospitals where most of the doctors are being trained.
And they provide free service, don't they?
Yes. They provide, like at least in Chad, they are providing free services, because most of these women, victim of fistula, they are very rural, living in very rural area. They are very poor women, and they cannot really have enough money to pay for the services.
Aren't some programs providing women with a delivery kit? What's in it? Belle, do you know?
No, I'm not really familiar with
that. Lynn, okay.
Well, there are some programs that have used what they call a clean delivery kit, which typically is just a handful of things, a clean razor blade, a plastic sheet, a clean thread. And while these are, it's better to have a clean delivery than an unclean delivery, there's a difference between that and a safe delivery. And so one of the things that's really important is that we not be fooled into thinking that that's going to solve the problem.
Well, in the old movies, the doctor would arrive with his little bag and he'd say, boil me some water.
Right.
And that seemed to work miracles.
Exactly.
Belle, let me ask you about Afghanistan. I know you know about that. The highest maternal mortality rate in the world. Is that connected to the war, or are there other factors?
Certainly it's connected to the war, and I think you'd find in most war zone areas that women have not been able to get access to care, certainly because of, the fact that the health facilities have been torn. There are all kinds of reasons why that is a factor, but certainly in Afghanistan, where it's high, a lot of that has to do, and most of it has to do with the fact that it's a war zone.
But during the Taliban years, women were only allowed to be seen by women doctors, and women doctors were prevented often from doing their jobs. So what happened when women were giving birth? The Taliban were using those, were using religious restrictions for keeping for setting these rules. How do religious rules affect maternal health?
I think it's important not necessarily to see those or name those kinds of restrictions as religious. I mean, they were very much not just about religion, but about power, about gender relations. And I think it's important for us to recognize that it is not just in Muslim countries that women are prevented from using services or that women are discriminated against. And, you know, this goes back also to your question about the three delays. We think about those delays, but the complex of reasons for each of them really come down to social, economic, political reasons that underpin the technical.
Well, one contributing factor is the lack of access to information about reproductive health and family planning in many of these countries. I remember years back when my sister worked in Bangladesh for the UN, and she had to get past the fact that many women who had problems producing breast milk would mix flour and water and offer that to their infants because it looked like breast milk. They had no idea that it was not really going to be very good for the child. Is there a way of, Grace, of providing the kind of information that's necessary?
Yes, absolutely, because just to get one more example, I mean, you have given this example of breast, but there are other examples like for eclampsia in Africa. This is one very common cause of death, but still in many places they are thinking there is no link between eclampsia and pregnancy. They think that it could be caused by some witch people.
Well, so, to explain eclampsia.
Yeah, to explain eclampsia. So this can, you know, they will first go for traditional treatment. It takes long time. And when the woman enters in deep coma, this is when they may take her to the hospital. And sometimes it's late. So it's very important, really, to use local people to, you know, spread accurate information about health problem, about family planning, about a lot of things. And this, the government really should contribute to do that. It can be done locally.
Eclampsia is a condition caused by high blood pressure. Mm-hmm. And women begin convulsing.
Coma. Yeah, they convulse.
And so the convulsions can, mm-hmm. I think what Grace was saying, can sometimes be thought to be caused by even witch.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. But why would high blood pressure cause this problem in a woman who's giving birth?
High blood pressure, this is everywhere, I mean, in the world. In the U.S., in Europe, in Africa, it's everywhere. So the blood pressure, you know, plays, I think, on the vessel in the brains, and it causes a vasoconstriction, so lack of blood going to the brain. And the consequences are fits. The woman will start to have fits, convulsion, and then they will progress into deep coma, and usually they die from cerebral hemorrhage. So it happened over all the world. It's not typically in Africa.
Now, all of these things are life-threatening for the mother, but
exactly.
Are they also life-threatening for the child?
Yes, because of the lack of blood going to the placenta, the baby may suffer and then die also. And this is one of the causes of stillbirth. So it's dangerous for both mother and the baby.
I can go back to the question of information for a second. I think when we think of information in the health area, we often think of things like you suggested, health information for education for people. But a really critical part of this field is the fact that the regular citizen in a country, in most high mortality countries, does not have information about the way the system is functioning. And one of the very big issues, and one that human rights organizations are taking up now, is the lack of transparency about how the system's working, how money is being channeled through a system, how the budget is being allocated. So when we think about access to information and maternal mortality, we should be thinking not only about health education, but really about people's access to information about the system that is supposed to be serving them.
How do diseases such as tuberculosis, malaria, AIDS affect maternal health? If a mother is infected, is she more likely to have problems in childbirth, let alone infect the child?
Exactly. HIV can be transmitted to child through many ways, during pregnancy or during childbirth or even during breastfeeding. The baby may have that. And also, this is like malaria, the same thing. Malaria is transmitted also to the baby. And malaria also causes anemia to the mother. And because she's anemic, she'll be very vulnerable. If she has some bleeding after delivery, she may die from that also. And baby may also be infected through the placenta.
Yeah, this recent data that the Lancet has just published actually shows us that in countries with high HIV, maternal mortality has been going up. And indeed, the conclusion of that study was that in East and Southern Africa, a very substantial portion of maternal deaths were due to HIV. I think the study thought something like 60,000 additional deaths a year due to HIV.
Bell, according to the World Health Organization, some 67,000 women die each year from botched abortions. In your article in Ms. Magazine, you give some examples of countries that have made changes to abortion laws, such as India, to address that issue. What happened there?
Well, basically, they legalized abortion, which is one of the biggest problems in the developing world. In Tanzania and Uganda, for example, where abortion is illegal, the highest number of abortions are really among young women because they can't get access to contraception. They don't have good information. And so that's one of the issues. I think when countries are seeing that when they've made abortion more accessible for women, then women will not die from unsafe abortions. And so that's one of the issues. The issue of getting information to women is so, so important. And that was one of the things that I saw in Tanzania and Uganda. And it's important to note that some communities are beginning to do some things about that. One of the strategies that they're using is theater. In Uganda and in Tanzania, they're working with organizations like Women's Dignity and in Gender Health to bring the information in a way that people can get it, that it resonates. And I saw that in Tanzania, both Uganda, where this plot or this play was played out by villagers where a woman was in her late stages of pregnancy. Her husband is sort of indifferent. Just demands that she goes to the field to chop wood while he carouses at the bar next door. She comes back from the field. She's now in dire straits and is having severe labor pains. They call for the traditional birth attendant, and the traditional birth attendant is not really skilled for any complications or trained, if you will. And so the traditional birth attendant comes and can't help the woman. Her baby dies. She dies. And then these women sing this song over her body about safe motherhood and what can Uganda women do to protect themselves from death from pregnancy. And you could see the faces of the villagers and the people who were there really just getting it. And that the whole point around this plot or this drama was that women should have a plan, you know, have a way to get to the facility. I'm sorry.
Yeah, finish.
I just wanted to say that that's the kind of information, those are the kinds of strategies that are low-cost strategies that really do make a difference in terms of whether or not women get good information about what they need to do to save their lives.
I just want to bring up the Democratic Republic of Congo, which has been called the worst place to be a woman in the world. And Grace, I know you've been there. How do you deal with that kind of crisis? You can't do plays.
But they're actually using plays. Exactly.
People are in refugee camps.
Displaced.
Many women have been raped as a consequence of the war. They're having children they don't even want to have.
Exactly. Because, I mean, during a war, during conflict, as you know very well, people are displaced, or health infrastructure have been destroyed, or even provider have been killed, or they just fled. So the services, again, is a real problem there in the eastern part of Congo.
Are doctors going in there to try to deal with the problem? And I'm assuming the same sort of situation in Haiti now, because so many people are living in makeshift camps.
Yes, and most of the doctors have fled. They have gone away because of the insecurity problem. So access to services is a real problem for the displaced people.
My thanks to all of you so much for being with us. Dr. Grace Kadindo of the Mailman School of Public Health at Columbia, Lynn Friedman also at Mailman, and Belle Taylor-McGee, who is president of the California Coalition for Reproductive Freedom. She wrote an article called Time to Save Women's Lives, which is in the spring issue of Ms. Magazine. Thank you so much for being with us today on our show.
Thank you.